So welcome to our first conference. Just to remind you what we talked about last night about the power of silence. And I kind of imagined it as if you're going to a part of the city that you would normally not go to alone. Because if you're walking there by yourself, you might be afraid of what might jump out at you. And so sometimes if we are alone with our thoughts, if we're silent, we're not reading, we're not talking to someone else, if it's just ourselves, we might be afraid of what ideas might jump out and grab us. And we talked about how that's what the brain does for a living. The brain just kind of presents ideas to us all the time. Some are good, some are not so good. Just because the brain presents an idea, it doesn't mean anything. After all, look at the things that popped into Jesus' mind in that time in the desert. Very, very awful thoughts, very selfish thoughts that jumped into Jesus' mind, and yet he didn't panic, he didn't take it personally, he didn't react at all. He simply said, no, I'm not going to do those things. And so dealing with those kinds of thoughts is the way that we become strong. It's the way that we strengthen ourselves to find that empowerment that we are all looking for. So silence is always our friend. And it's something that we just don't have too often in our world, so having it on this weekend is a good thing. And that you might find some of the thoughts coming into your head, how to distinguish them between memories of your past, something Aunt Mary told you when you were a kid, to how to distinguish it with our Lord. And the words of our Lord are always and only encouraging. That's the voice of God. It cannot be anything else. It is only and always encouraging, telling you that with his grace, you can do this. You can conquer this sin. You can strengthen this virtue. You can develop this habit with his grace. His words are always that beautiful. Sometimes the words that we give each other are not that beautiful. And so our theme this week, this weekend, is the family, modeled on the Holy Family. And I'm going to be bringing in the Ten Commandments. But what are the words that we often hear within families? I'm so disappointed in you. Why don't you do this? How come you don't go to Mass? How come this? How come that? Right? And those are hurtful words that, you know, usually just don't accomplish very much. And in a way, one of the things that kind of defines family is the difficulty that we have in getting someone else to do what we want them to do, right? Why don't you listen to what I'm saying? You know, that happens between parents and children. And you know, sometimes parents and children, they have this falling out, and sometimes parents can say, well, things didn't work out as well as I would have liked with my children, but I have a second bite at the apple. I have a second chance. There's the grandkids. Do you know why grandparents and grandchildren get along so well? They have a common enemy. So I want to talk a little bit about this idea of getting someone else to do what we want. And either, you know, sometimes we're successful, but more often than not, we're not getting someone else to do what we want. Of course, you can imagine people will almost never do what you want if you are yelling at them, right? So just look at yourself. Have you ever done anything because someone else yelled at you? No. God designed us actually to resist that. It's actually God's will that people resist when we're yelling at them. So that's a normal thing. So let me just kind of begin with this idea of the Ten Commandments. Now, how many of you saw Charlton Heston lead the Israelites across the Red Sea? Great. You know, that really was really a blockbuster movie. It was an amazing event, and ironically, it was based on something completely wrong. Innocent, well-intentioned, noble, even honorable, but wrong. and has led to a misunderstanding of that story from generations, because most people understand the story of the Exodus from movies and television. And because The Ten Commandments by Cecil B. DeMille was the iconic movie of all other movie presentations of that story have followed on the same path. Because there's an intuitive goodness about it. I said it's honorable, well-intentioned, sincere, but wrong. Now, what was the problem with the Israelites? They were slaves, right? And you know who likes slavery? And Pharaoh is a mean person, and he is just so terrible and so mean. And so Moses says, you know what? We don't like slavery. We don't like this life that we have in Egypt. We are leaving. Does that sound familiar? That's not why they left. The book of Exodus clearly states in the very beginning why they left. And it has nothing to do with slavery. It has nothing to do with slavery. You might know, this is going to sound kind of shocking, but the Israelites volunteered to be slaves. They were not captured. They volunteered. And actually, that was quite common in the ancient world. You know, the ancient world had a different economy than we have today. If the crop failed, you know, you basically died. You starved. There was just no other recourse. If the harvest didn't come in, you know, you were stuck. So what a lot of people would do is say, since there's no food here, well, why should we stay here and die? We're going to move to where there is food, right? And so there was a great famine in the land of Israel. People were dying, and so they packed up, went to Egypt voluntarily, and said, we'll work for food, right? Slavery was not like it is in the Civil War era in this country, which was truly horrific. Slavery in the ancient world was actually sometimes honorable. It was just not the same. We just can't, they're completely different. Civil War, slavery in this country, slavery in the ancient world. It was very common for people to volunteer to be slaves. So they went to Egypt to become slaves, and things were working out very well. There was no problem because there was food. Now, the Israelites were Jewish. They followed Yahweh. And at one point, they went to Pharaoh and said, we're Jews. We are Israelites. We follow Yahweh. It's time for our annual religious holiday, religious celebration. So we want a three-day weekend to go into the desert. You can read this in the beginning of chapter 5. We want a three-day weekend. He didn't say three-day weekend, but, you know, he does say 3 days. We want 3 days to go into the desert to have our special worship for Yahweh. And then it doesn't say why, but Pharaoh says no. And no reason is given, you know, because he's Pharaoh. So he says no. That's what began the Exodus. Basically, to sum up the book of Exodus, the Israelites say, we're happy being slaves here. We'll stay for the rest of our lives, but we will never stay in a place where we cannot practice our faith. Doesn't that make sense? We will not stay in a place if we cannot practice our faith, even if it means no food. We came here for the food, but we will not stay if we cannot live our faith, if we cannot practice our faith. Well, then it became kind of a Trump-Pelosi battle after that. Right? Right? You can't tell me what to do. Oh, yes, I can tell you what to do. And so, so Moses and Pharaoh got into this mano-a-mano fight back and forth, you know, with the stick turning into a snake and all these different, you know, wild things and the plagues and all that. So eventually they leave, and the Exodus begins. But it's just very important to remember that the Exodus began for religious reasons, not economic reasons. Now, why did Cecil B. DeMille not include that? Cecil B. DeMille was an extremely devout Jew, right? He was a very, very, that's why he made the film, because he was a very, very faithful Jewish guy. But that film was made in 1955, okay? I was 3 years old, remember it well, no. And if you remember, that was really the height of the Cold War. And Joseph McCarthy was rooting out communists in the government, and it was, you know, the Korean War had just finished, and communism and tensions everywhere. And so Cecil B. DeMille wanted to make an anti-communist film. He was also a very patriotic American. So he was a very religious, patriotic American. He wanted to make a patriotic film anti-communist. Does that make sense? So what was the thing about communism was economics, socialism. And so Cecil B. DeMille wanted to show how the story was based on slavery, on economic slavery, which he equated with communism as economic slavery. Does this make sense? So he based the film on economic slavery because he wanted the moviegoers to recognize that communism was like Pharaoh, evil and bad. And so he just innocently and for a noble purpose took out the religious dimension of it and based it entirely on politics, if you will. Now, just as a quick aside, you know how some years ago there was this debate about whether you can post the Ten Commandments in various government buildings? You know how they got into those government buildings? This is really fascinating. In 1955, as a way of promoting the film, Cecil B. DeMille paid for and bought and produced thousands and thousands and thousands of copies of the Ten Commandments and mailed them to courthouses around the country. So the reason they got there first was to promote the film. and then it became kind of the constitutional battle after that, and some places won and some places didn't. So we know that the Exodus story, the Ten Commandments, came from a desire for religious freedom, not freedom from slavery. They had no problem with slavery. They had a big problem with not being able to practice their faith. So then they go into the desert and they receive these Ten Commandments. Now remember, in this issue of trying to influence someone else, because this is a key area where people find peace or discord, right? Because if you think about it, much of our discord, much of our sense of not finding peace is the disappointment we have in the people around us. My children don't go to church, my husband is this, my neighbor is that, my boss is this. The difficulty we have in changing them, you know, and so we just kind of live sometimes in a continual cloud of disappointment and anger and maybe sometimes resentment and bitterness. But look at the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are addressed to the Israelites, not the Egyptians. They are addressed to the Israelites. They are not addressed to the Egyptians. God is saying to the Israelites, change yourself. Don't try to change the Egyptians. I got another plan for them. This is my plan for you. Now, that is a source of wisdom that is amazing. What God is saying is, the only person that you can reliably change is yourself. You know, your chance of changing someone else, good luck. I'll give you some hints on that, God says, and Jesus has some hints on that. But the vast majority of the Bible is about changing yourself. Now, just to be fair, I'm actually writing another book on the chapter of Luke 10. And that is Jesus' plan, how to change someone else. But he says, you'll barely be successful, but here's a plan. But the entire rest of the Bible is addressed to a person to change themselves. Now, why would he do that? Why is that the percentage? Why is that the percentage? Why is that the plan, to change myself and not worry about changing others? Well, it's a way of God respecting a number of gifts that he placed in our human nature that he's not going to interfere with. And one of them is freedom, autonomy, independence, right? We are just not in charge of other people. They don't belong to us. So the difficulty that we have in changing other people is really a way of affirming God's plan for each human person, that each person has to be in charge of themselves and doesn't actually belong to another. So God gives these Ten Commandments to the Israelites in this really remarkable story at the at Mount Sinai. And let's take a look at these. We're going to talk more about this changing others and changing ourselves really throughout the whole weekend. But let me just talk about the meaning of the Ten Commandments. Because they're, you know, they've been around so long, they've been posted everywhere, we're so used to it, but I just want to kind of back up and get a little bit of a different, or really kind of the main view of really what they mean. Because we take them for granted so much, we forget really, if you heard them for the very first time, what might you think, right? So I want you to imagine this. So a very favorite person that you love very, very much, child. No, I didn't mean it that way. Of course not your spouse, no. No, I didn't mean that. You'll get what I'm saying when I finish this. Of course not your spouse. Strike that on the tape, please. So a very much loved child or grandchild, okay, comes to you and says, "Mom or grandmother, you'll never guess what happened. I met the love of my life. I just met the love of my life. After all these years, finally, I know this is the one. I can't tell you how happy I am to be with this person. I don't want to mess it up. I don't want it to go south. And, you know, I'm coming to you for advice." Now, isn't that the greatest line you've ever heard? I mean, isn't that one of the most beautiful things that anyone can ever say to you? "I'm coming to you for your wisdom, your advice." And they say, "Grandmother or Mom, I'm so happy with this person, and I just don't want to mess it up. So can you please, you know, give me a few words of advice to make sure that this relationship lasts?" And you look at this person, and you say, "Don't steal from them. Don't lie about them. And don't kill them." And this is the big advice that you have? I come to you as Mrs. Wisdom, and this is what you tell me? But those are three of the commandments, right? Don't lie, don't steal, don't kill. And you're saying, this is ridiculous. Who needs to tell me that, right? And actually, you don't need to be told that. If you love someone, the last thing that's on your mind is that you're going to steal from them. It would never occur to you to lie about them. And you probably wouldn't even think about killing them eventually, you know? That comes later. Now, think about it. So the Ten Commandments are actually superfluous for someone who has a big heart. If someone is in love, they don't need the Ten Commandments at all. The Ten Commandments are written for people who don't love. That make sense? They're written for people who, you have to tell them this because they might do it. If you're, you know, if you're leaving the house and you tell your kids, "Don't turn on this channel," why do you say that? Because you know that they might, right? If you know your kids would never turn on that channel, there would be no need to say it. So any of those thou shalt nots are actually statements to people who might shall, who are thinking about doing it. Does that make sense? So the Ten Commandments are superfluous for someone who has a great heart. They are really written for people, you know, who are not doing this, okay? Even the first three about religion, because the first three are about faith and the rest are about human relationships. So the first three are about vertical relationships, our relationship with God, keep holy the Lord's day, don't have any other gods before me, and don't take my name in vain. And all the others are horizontal about our relationship with each other. But again, it's always about myself and how I am going to live, right? And if I have that great sense of heart, if I have that great sense of love in my heart, then the Ten Commandments are superfluous. So he's giving these Ten Commandments to these Israelites, and he's saying, this is our way. I'll take care of the Egyptians. You manage and control yourself. I remember when I was young, I was 9 years old when I moved to Thousand Oaks. And before that, I lived in New Jersey. I normally don't admit that, but I lived in New Jersey near Newark, beautiful Newark, and we lived on a dead-end street. When I came to California, I found out that was called a cul-de-sac. Right? In New Jersey, it's a dead-end street. So when I was young, I was 9 years old when I left. So before that, you know, and typically a lot of kids my age on that street, we would play and run around. And at one point, the signal to come home in those days was when the porch light came on, right? So, you know, we didn't have play dates. We had no chaperones. I mean, basically, when school was out, there was only one rule of the day, which was get outside and play, right? Get outside and play. That was it. And parents had no idea where their kids were, just the way we liked it. Completely different now, I know that. And I'm not going to say whether it's good or bad, but I like my time better. So basically the word was get out and play. So we did. But when the porch light came on, we had to come back. Because the porch light meant it was dark. Obviously, one day the porch light comes on earlier than I think it should, and I come home, and I said to my folks, I said, how come I have to come home now? Georgie Thorman across the street gets to stay out later. How come I have to come home now? And very calmly, my folks said something that I think has been echoed for many, many families. They said, look, anytime a sentence begins with look, pay attention. So look, Georgie Thorman is in the Thorman home. They do things their way. You're in the Heaney family, and we do things our way. And I thought that was an incredibly stupid answer. But it had an effect. It slowly began to have an effect, which was I began to recognize there was the Heaney way of doing things. It didn't make any moral judgment on the Thorman family. It didn't say whether we were better or worse than them. It's just that there is our way, right? So my folks weren't asking me to change the Thorman family, and they weren't asking to change us. But they were just saying, this is our way of doing things. And that was the way that the Israelites understood the Ten Commandments when they received them. This is the Israelite way of doing things. Does that make sense? It's the culture. If you want a very simple definition of the word culture, it's a big sociological word, not really. Culture simply means the way we do things, right? What's the culture of Sacred Heart Retreat House, right? It's the way they do things. Breakfast at this time, this over here, you know, that kind of thing. So culture, whether it's a family or a convent or a parish or a society, is the way we do things. And the Ten Commandments kind of identified the way that we do things. it's not exactly like the Thorman family, but you know, it's the way that the Heaney family operates. So let me just say just a couple of words about the first commandment, and then I'll open it up to questions. We'll have any questions if on the topic, and if there's a few questions on that, we'll deal with those. If there's, or if that's, or it can be on anything that you like. So the first commandment is, thou shalt worship the God, worship Yahweh and Yahweh alone. All right, so it's a stylized way of saying we're faithful to one, we are loyal to one, we stay with one, right? We don't shift around like the Egyptians do to different gods, which they did many, many times over their culture. But the Israelites, our way of doing things is we're going to have one person that we follow. And that parallels that story I told you last night about the eighth grade graduation, right? That here you have all these different principals, and when you go to high school, you're going to have the dean of this and the dean of that and the dean of this and the vice dean of that and then the principal. And I said, ignore all of them. Don't pay attention to any of them. I always love their reaction, the principals, when I say that, and the parents. But then when I tell them, just follow Jesus and everything will fall into place, everybody understands. So that idea of the simplicity of focus, you know, is a very, very powerful lesson, the simplicity of focus. We follow one God, we follow one person. This is more than just an act of faith. And if you, you know, there's obviously a kind of a relatively small, recent rise of atheism, right? Or people who write none for religious affiliation. But here's a way of understanding this idea that really is kind of a secular understanding from a psychological viewpoint that would make sense to any atheist. I want you to think back to the very earliest memory that you can remember. Just the very earliest time. Most medical people will say that that's going to be around the age between 4 and 2, maybe three. That we really cannot have a retained memory of anything before the age of 3, all right? It may be anecdotal, there might be someone who's, you know, remarkable that has an earlier one, but generally speaking, 3 is about as far back as you can go. That's largely a factor of brain development, right? Just the synapses are not connected enough for you to retain these things. It's always intriguing to me when I, you know, there's a brand new phenomenon in schools right now called TK. Anybody have a TK in their school? So we have a TK, transitional kindergarten, right? Like the longest term for the shortest kids, you know? Transitional kindergarten, huh? What's that? So I often think these kids are running around the field and having a good time and they're just enjoying themselves. And I say, you know, everything that they're doing right now, they're not going to remember. Or if you have your 2 and 3 year olds, you know, seeing those kids, you know, running around happy, playing with the dog or whatever, whatever they're doing, they will have no memory of ever for the rest of their life. They experience it, obviously they're experiencing it right now, but they're not going to have any memory of that. So just think back to your earliest memory. Maybe it's just an image, a stairway, a door, the front of the house, a car, a dog. Probably it's just an image, not even like a movie, but just an image. However far back you go, however early that memory is, it's the first memory that you can remember. At the time that you had that memory, at the time that you had that experience, you had already been alive for several years. And so that is a very profound personal experience of a simple fact. You did not cause yourself to be born. You did not make yourself alive. You discovered yourself already alive many years, several years after the event. Does that make sense? Right? You discovered yourself alive after a couple of years after you were born. That tells you a very powerful idea. Someone else is in charge. Someone else caused you to be born. Now, it's a truism to say that parents cause their children to be born, but you have to make the case why you were born, because you occupy only one body. And so why are your consciousness, who you are as a person, why are you alive here in the 21st century in the Western Hemisphere, in the Northern Hemisphere, and here in Southern California and in Alhambra? Why did you become born? Someone else is in charge of you. And that is a profound, non-religious, purely scientific, secular understanding of the role of God in the creation of the universe and the creation of you. And so the origin of this first commandment, to have the Lord your God, to thou shalt worship God alone. So it's that idea of worship, you know, that we're saying, God, you caused me to become in being, you caused me to be born, and so I acknowledge you as that source, and I praise you. I might ask you for a few things, but first I simply acknowledge that, and I praise you. That has to be the start of any form of changing ourself, right? Because that's our whole theme, is changing myself, changing ourself. And what has to be the ground of changing ourself is first knowing where we stand. And where do we stand? As creatures of God, who knows what he's doing. So I'll just end with this idea. Everything I'm telling you right now can be found in a book. I'm not the author of this book. I wish I was. It was one of the wisest books I've ever read. I'll give you the title. This book has changed my life, and I think it will change yours. The book is The Owner's Manual for Your Car. You've read it? Then you know. If you've read it, you know. It's very moving. Well, actually, I just 3 days ago got a new car. Thanks be to God, my old car died. I hated that car. I said, dear Lord, please let this be the day this car dies. Finally, it died. And so I got another car. I got a Dodge Journey. Never had a Dodge before. It's a small SUV. And so actually driving it here yesterday was really kind of the first trip since the dealership. Everything went well. And you know what I'm doing? I'm reading the car manual, right? You know, because you got to know how to turn on the headlights and all that stuff. Well, in there is just one of the most beautiful phrases you can ever possibly read. Tire pressure must be... No, that's not it. The most beautiful phrase, it says, this vehicle operates best when operated according to manufacturer's instructions. So beautiful. I operate best when I operate according to my manufacturer's instructions, right? We operate best when we operate according to the person who brought us into being, right? This is the person we are. This first commandment gets to everything in the right perspective, right? I am God, you are my creature. I created you. Let's get that straight, he's saying. You will operate best when you operate according to the way that I made you. You will operate best when you operate according to the way I made you, and I did not make you in charge of someone else. I made you in charge of yourself. Okay, so let me just invite you then, if you like, just to keep these very simple ideas in mind. We're not dealing with your grandkids. We're not dealing with your children. We're dealing with you. and your relationship with your creator, the one who made you, who wants you to be happy and knows just how to make that happen.